You're listening to Central Illinois Business. Hi, Alex Ruggieri here. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show. We have a very interesting show for you this morning. We're starting out with Mary Shores, who was on the show not too long ago when she published her new book. And we are turning the tables a little bit because I've just published a book, and Mary's here actually to interview me today. So welcome.
Hey, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I am so excited to be here with Alex. I've been on the show many times over the years, and I'm so flattered that Alex chose me to interview him for his launch of his book. So I wanted to start off as a huge thank you and present Alex with this. I know you guys can't see this, but it's a beautiful Words That Work mug because Alex is a huge fan of my Words That Work business communication strategy.
Oh, wonderful. That is a beautiful mug, too.
Yeah, I love that mug. It's nice and robust. Yeah. Plenty of room for coffee there.
Yeah, I like the colors, too.
So, Alex, you are just launching The Executive's Guide to Buying Commercial Property, How to Avoid Common Pitfalls When Buying a Building by Alex Ruggieri and Noah. So
That's
your
right.
son must have helped you a little
bit. He did help me with some editing and ideas.
So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, what was interesting about the reason for the book is because I just got my 40-year pin, and people who listen to this show know that I have a day job, which is commercial real estate. And over the last several decades, I've just run into so many different situations where people, well, they did things that made their life a lot more difficult with regard, you know, to their purchase and maybe with regard to the way they set things up, which prohibited them from doing what they wanted to do later, either with the building or with the move or whatever. I do an awful lot of corporate counseling, corporate relocations, working with companies, helping them to learn how to expand their businesses. I do an awful lot of work with not-for-profits because they need real estate too. Many times people are really good at their core businesses, but they don't know anything about real estate. And what ends up happening is, I don't know, I'm dating myself, but there used to be a commercial that, you know, with these kids sitting around with Life cereal, and they didn't want to try it because it looked too strange, and they conspire and they say, let's get Mikey to try it, right? And so Mikey ends up trying the cereal. But anyway, that's what people do is they're like, oh, we need a new building. What do we do? Oh, let's get Joe. He's the CFO. He'll know what to do, okay? And Joe is the CPA. I mean, he's a CFO. He's really smart. He's good with numbers. So, you know, but he's probably never bought a building in his life. He's probably never built a building in his life. And or they'll dump it on executive director's desk. You know, hey, Jim runs that office. We'll give it to Jim. Well, guess what? Jim has to run the day-to-day affairs, the core competencies of that business, which is a full-time job. And to dump, okay, we need you to learn how to, you know, find a location for the new building, learn how to negotiate with all of the contractors and build a new building on top of your regular job, it usually doesn't work out real good, but that's the way people do it. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a handbook. And that this is really not a tome. It's not, you know, a library reference material. It's just a solid handbook you can read, you know, in one sitting, really, or a couple of sittings to give you the basics of what you need to look for and what you need to avoid.
And books like this are a good reference guide,
yeah.
You know, so you could do a quick read through once,
yep.
And then you keep it, and then when you need to go back to it, you can just go right back to that particular section.
Right.
Something that you said at the very beginning about, you know, this radio show is not the day job.
Right,
you know,
right.
The day job is the real estate.
Yes.
And so I'm very much the same way. You know,
it's what allows me to do this.
Right. I run Mid-State Collections,
yep.
And I developed Words That Work, and then I became an author and a speaker,
public speaker
on the side. So I very much understand. And what I know about that is that the drive to do that, when you have a separate day job, which is really what where you're making your money, and you're doing like the radio show and all of this stuff, you're not getting paid to do that.
Nope.
There's a real passion that comes through. And so I think
I
we have that in
following
common.
Your bliss.
Yes. So I want to know, like, what are your passions when it comes to real estate and why you want to share those passions with the world?
I am really passionate about people. I love people and I love mixing it up with people. That's why I go to a lot of conferences and I love networking with people and that kind of thing. And I especially like being able to help people. And so if there's something I can do to help somebody, I'm always going to do it. I had a lady just called. She sold her veterinary practice, and she called all these banks, and nobody knew how to help her with a 1031 exchange. And there's no money in it for me at all. I didn't sell it. I'm not selling her the next property. But I just counseled with her on the phone on the way to the radio station. Let me tell you, you need a 1031 accommodator, and I know a great one in California, a great one in Texas, and there's one right here in town. Let me give you all their names, all their numbers, and I get juiced being, you know, she's like, wow, that's great. That's just what I need, you know, helping people. So that's one of my passions.
Well, and you know, that actually just leads me right into my next question, which is like, you know, it sounds to me that you've got a real expertise and a knack for this, because I mean, if she's calling this person you're talking about, she's calling specifically into a place that should have some knowledge or should be able to point her in the right direction, but she's really getting nowhere. And we all know what that feels like, because whether it's about real estate or whether it's about our taxes or, you know, really even our health, you really need to have that person who is an expert that knows exactly what you need. And so I see here a real expertise. Take us back to, like, what was it like just, you know, learn, like, how did you learn the 1031? I mean, what were the first steps of you becoming an expert in this niche of commercial real estate?
Sure. Well, and, you know, expert is an interesting term. All I can say is I'm a student, and I continue to learn. I will take it that far. But I started out in residential real estate 40 years ago and ultimately decided that my forte really was more in commercial. And the main reason for that was because I had 5 children. And when you sell residential real estate, and I was reasonably successful at it, but when you sell residential real estate, people, they want you after five when they get off of work, and they want you Saturdays when they're not working, and they want you Sundays when you're not working.
Open houses.
Yeah, they want you to do open houses. They want you to show them houses. And that was fine when my kids were little and they didn't care if daddy was home or not. But as they got older, I realized, you know, am I going to be an absentee dad? And so I thought, well, I like real estate. I like working with people. And I had, at that time, 10 years invested into the career. So I thought, I'm going to switch over and I'm going to do commercial real estate. Because the interesting thing about commercial real estate is that it is very much a 9-to-5 kind of job. I mean, nobody wants to talk to you after 5 o'clock unless they're going to take you to dinner or something. And nobody wants to see you on a Saturday unless they want you to play golf with them or something. And so I was suddenly able to, you know, be home every evening and go to the soccer games on Saturday mornings and all of that. And in order to do that, I had to have a big paradigm shift in terms of what my knowledge base was. So I went back to school. I went through the University of Illinois' Executive MBA program, and I got my MBA. And then I started taking courses in real estate. National Association of Realtors has a phenomenal course through what's called CCIM. And it's a whole curriculum. And you go through that, and then you get that designation. So I got that designation. And then I started getting involved with exchange groups. So the Society of Exchange Counselors is the oldest one in the country, and they're something like 50 years old. And then also the National Council of Exchangers. So they do education at every one of their meetings. So I take a course 6 to 8 times a year, and I've been doing that for 15 years now. So you end up learning a lot of stuff. Do I ever get to the point where I know it all? No, but I know enough to talk intelligently and to help people about it. And then I ended up getting involved in leadership. So I was the president of National Council of Exchangers in 2017. And I am on the board of governors of the Society of Exchange Counselors. So that's kind of my background and how I developed a little bit of expertise over the years.
Well, I am thoroughly 100% convinced that you're an expert in this. You know, and I love when it's either Malcolm Gladwell or it's Seth Godin. I mean, sometimes I get those two confused because their writing, both of their writing are so prolific.
Yes.
And one of the things is that I think it might be Gladwell says to become an expert, you need your 10,000 hours. And
yes.
I did, being the nerd that I am, one day I sat
it was
with
Gladwell,
the calculator.
By the way.
Was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I sat with the calculator to figure out how much time you need for 10,000 hours, and it's about 10 years.
Wow.
It's about 10 years to become an expert.
Wow.
So, I mean, you're 40 years into your
yep.
career, and you've
yep.
done all of these things, and actually, I think it was brilliant to go back and get the MBA,
yep.
because that really helps, that helped distinguish you to have business relationships versus residential relationships.
Right.
So, thank
right.
you for sharing that.
Well, yeah, no, and that's an excellent program, by the way. University of Illinois is an incredible asset we have right here in town.
You know, my son, Keegan, just got accepted into the University of Illinois College of Engineering.
Oh,
and I'm super, super excited.
It's one of the top schools in the world
engineering. It really is. It's the sixth top school. And, you know, what's really special about it is he's on the autism spectrum. And so he's had some obstacles in his path. So I'm super excited for him to start that program.
Have you ever heard of, and we have just a few seconds before we have to go to break, but have you ever heard of Temple Grandin?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Wow. We do a thing called Cousins Camp. We have all my grandkids come to our house for a week. And they all have to read biographies and profiles during that week, and then they give a report at the end of the week on who they learned. And they get to pick, you know, from a whole bunch of books that we buy and say, you know, do you want to learn about, you know, Rosa Parks, or do you want to learn about, you know, Helen Keller, whoever it is. And they had never heard of Temple Grandin. And so I got the movie. Did you ever see the movie?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I got the movie on Netflix, and we all sat down. Here's all these kids from, you know, 7 to 18 watching this lady who's on the autism spectrum and how she literally changed the world in a lot of ways. And it's just incredible what people can do, even with autism. In fact, she gives a great TED talk where she says, if we didn't have autism, we might not even have civilization.
We'd still be in the Stone Age.
That's right. She says that. So we got to go to break, but we'll pick up and talk more about that when we get back. Please stay with us. And we're back. You're listening to Central Illinois Business. And we've turned the tables here a little bit today. Normally, I'm the one who's giving the interviews, but my guest, Mary Shores, is actually interviewing me today, and I'm just delighted. Mary being a very successful author in her own right and speaker. And we were just talking about the book, which is The Executive Guide to Buying Commercial Property. And the reason that I wrote that book is simply because so many people make so many mistakes when they buy commercial real estate, and they end up putting the responsibility on the desk of the president or the CFO or the CEO, and they're probably really good at what they do, and they're brilliant people, they're intelligent people, but you know, it's just like, hey, if you give them a skateboard and say, okay, we want you to do the tube, they're probably not going to be able to do it real well if it's the first time they've ever done it. And that's the thing about commercial real estate. It takes a little bit of expertise and a little bit of experience to know not only what to do, but what not to do. And there's a lot of stories in the book about people who did certain things and, you know, it really cause them problems down the road.
You know, what I've learned in my industry of the debt collections company, I mean, sometimes it's just one little box on one little form changes the trajectory of everything after that. And you didn't even understand how important that the intricacies of that one little thing was going to mean. So I'm super excited about this book. Alex and I have had a relationship for several years. He's just always been a fan of my work and invited me into the studio and been so generous with studio time. And so I wanted to, in this next segment, have a little bit of author to author chat.
Okay.
So let's talk about the writing process. Like, I know we talked about your inspiration for the book, but tell me a little bit about your writing process, and if you're interested, I can share a little bit of mine.
I'd be very interested to learn, because your book is fantastic. You start out with, you know, we all carry our smartphones and things like that. Well, I've got a little notepad on my smartphone, which I can also dictate to, and so when an idea would pop into my head, I would write it down. And so then when it came time to do some writing, I would look at those notes and I would kind of start to build the outline from that. And it is a process. I mean, if anybody's ever, it's like having a baby. I mean, it just takes a long, long time. And sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's uncomfortable. And then I have an editor that I work with in New York who works with my publishing company. And he was great. I mean, but, you know, I mean, they'll just rip through your stuff, you know, and then you're like, what, you know? This isn't like some of those movies you see where, you know, the guy writes the book and then people want to change it. And he's like, no, I'm not changing a word. That's my book. You can't do that. You've got to take their advice because they're the ones that do it every day. And here I am talking to people about, hey, you need to take my advice because I do this every day. So it's silly to hire people like that and then not take their advice. And they're really good at what they do. So you have to then hone and edit and make it better so that by the time it comes out, it really is worth somebody's time to read.
You said so many brilliant things in that answer, and I know from my own experience that when I first got into the writing, and you know my story, for years I had wanted to write a book, and yes. I feel like there's just those like people don't understand the first few steps of getting started, and I think that a lot of people actually sit down and they have in this perception that writers sit down and just write a book, that they just go chapter one,
like Stephen King,
right, and they just whip out. That, you know, it might take forever, but they whip out chapter by chapter. And you really did the same thing that I did, which was by starting with an outline.
Yeah.
And your strategy of using your smartphone when you get an idea to talk to yourself into the phone is really smart. Because when I first got started, what I did was I was doing talks like at, I would be invited to teach a workshop somewhere, and I would record those just on my cell phone, and then I would get them transcribed. And it was really that transcription that I was able to work with an editor with
fantastic.
To get a proposal so that I could turn that proposal into the editor. And I love, too, that you talked about this relationship with the editor. Mm-hmm. Because when they are going through and they're making corrections, I never had that attitude either, because I understood inside, outside, backwards, and forwards that this editor was picking up on things that were only going to serve to make the book better. So, for example, I might have brought up a concept in the book that I'm very much used to talking about, and I didn't maybe put a definition to the concept, or they wanted me to refer to this concept maybe earlier so that there would be a loop back to that concept. So I would find those things very easy to just fit in and mold into the way that they wanted it. And to be honest, I mean, the book is just only better because of that editing process.
Right.
So did you experience that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, I came to welcome it because I knew what was going on. And it's a little bit like maybe your teenager or something, at first, or any situation where you're trying to help somebody and then, they're pushing back and pushing back. And then all of a sudden they realize, hey, he's just trying to help me here, And then they become part of the process.
Well, I was a bit nervous about my big time New York City publisher editor from Hay House. So I actually contracted an editor to help me before I even turned my first draft in.
Wow.
Which they did. I mean, Hay House did such a great job. I don't know that I actually needed that, but it was sort of my own security blanket.
Sure,
so
sure.
I shelled out a couple thousand bucks just to work with this editor privately.
Yes.
And you know what? I was really glad that I did, because they did story development with me.
Mm,
you know, they really helped me understand, like, put a story here, because that's going to help illustrate the teaching. And I feel like even because of that, the book was so much better. So one of the things that I noticed when I was writing is that the synchronicities of information that just started coming to me, it was almost like the things that I was writing about in the book started to show up in my life. And even though our books, you know, are completely two different genres, I'm curious if that happened to you as well.
You know, I never thought of it that way until you just said that. And all of a sudden, these, like, things just popped in my brain, like, hey, yeah, that has kind of happened. And it's very interesting. I wonder what's going on. There must be some kind of a cosmic thing happening between our minds, our hearts, and our dreams as we put them on paper that make them come to life.
You know, what I've found in speaking to other authors is it's a known phenomenon. And so what I think,
really?
And this just draws back a little bit of the science of the subconscious mind that's in my book, Conscious Communications,
yes.
is whatever is sort of going on is what becomes in our peripheral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like what we're searching for unknowingly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so these things start to appear, and I would get fed these little tidbits of things that were going to be just the perfect story or the perfect idea for the book. So I'm glad you experienced that too, because it's actually kind of cool. So when you write your next one, you'll know ahead of time.
That's interesting. You say other authors mention that.
Oh, it's a known, it's a very known phenomenon. And so the next thing I want to know is, when I was writing, one of the things too is, like, how do you organize your thoughts? You know, because a great book, especially a guidebook like this, seems to have, like, a starting point, you know, a middle, and an ending.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I think it was along the lines of the process, the transactional process. So when you're going to do something with commercial real estate, well, you know, you have to make a decision. Are you going to buy or are you going to build? Okay. And so I kind of went through that scenario. Then once they made that decision, then it was like, okay, so you're going to buy a building. All right, first thing you have to do is, you know, put together your team. You know, people think, well, you got to find a building. Well, no, you have to put together your team. Because you're going to be needing expertise that you don't have. And so you should have, obviously I'm prejudiced, but you should have a good realtor. That should be on your team, right? And you need to have a real estate attorney. I mean, you know, not the guy who does family law, you know, or the guy who goes to court every day, but the guy who does transactional real estate all the time, and he's really good at it. You need to have an accountant, a CPA. You know, these are the kinds of people that you need to have on your team. And so you put that together first. Then you start, okay, let's find a building. And then there's just a whole bunch of things that go, you know, from start to finish. And then even after you get the building, there's what we call due diligence. And that's where you start studying up on, okay, we've got the building under contract. Can we even do what we want to do with it? So, like, I mean, there's a story in there about some people who bought a piece of ground that they were going to build their business on it, and they didn't even realize, because they had worked with a residential realtor, not a commercial realtor, that the zoning wasn't appropriate for what they wanted to do. So they went, closed on it, paid for it, and everything else. Then they went to start get a building permit, and the government body said, you can't build that there. They're like, what? We just spent all this money, we spent all this time, and, you know, we got the architect and this, and the contractor, nope, it's against the zoning laws. Well, what do? Well, you have to change the zoning law. You have to change the zoning there. And that, like in their case, took a lot of work. It took almost a year of petitioning, and then neighbors came out against it. And every, I mean, they finally were able to build it, and it's absolutely beautiful. It worked out great. But why would you go through that? I mean, there's no reason that you need to go through that if you put together the right team.
That's brilliant, because it's just like that thing I was saying, that when you go to the beginning and you check the wrong box.
Yes.
So my final question for you is, I would love to know, who is the best audience for this book? Do you feel like this is somebody that's already doing commercial real estate, or can someone like me as a business owner just pick one up? And what are going to be, like, what is the main takeaway that you want someone to walk away from this book?
Well, first of all, it's really a layman's guide. It's set up so that the guy who runs the company, whose expertise is in one area, can read this as a primer and get up to speed pretty quick on what, at least, you know, he shouldn't do, and some of the things that they should do. So it's a real quick, easy read, and it's for anybody who is thinking about buying a piece of real estate, and you're making probably one of the biggest investments your company is going to make, and you want to make sure you get it right. And that's where the book comes in. So anybody who's thinking about buying, leasing, or building commercial real estate.
All right. And do we have time to say, where can we find the book?
Oh, absolutely. It is available on Amazon, which is really easy to use nowadays online. It's called The Executive's Guide to Buying Commercial Property by Alex Ruggieri and Noah Ruggieri. And if you search Executive's Guide to Buying Commercial Property, it pops right up.
All right, folks, pick up your copy today. I think you'll be happy you did.
Well, I wanted to talk more about your book, too, but we'll have to have you back to do that again.
I'd love to.
Okay, thank you, Mary. And don't go away. Much more after the break. And we're back. You're listening to Central Illinois Business. Alex Ruggieri here. And in the second half of the hour, I have a wonderful interview ready for you, lined up with Stephen Altop, who is the music director and conductor of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm just delighted. And I think I've told you before, Barbara Hedlund has been kind of a regular on the show. We really love the symphony and all the things you're doing, and I try to have her on once or twice a year to let us know what's going on. And you were kind enough to agree to do the interview this year, and we'll get your perspective now. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what's happening. First of all, tell folks, what is the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra?
The Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra is the professional orchestra in residence at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Mm-hmm. And it is an ensemble that includes faculty members from the School of Music at the University of Illinois. It includes some students, particularly graduate students from the University of Illinois, and community musicians from the Champaign-Urbana Central Illinois area.
Oh, outstanding. And how long have you been with the Symphony Orchestra?
I'm about to start my sixth season with the orchestra.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Now, as a director and a conductor, certainly you have background in music. Do you also play an instrument?
I do. I'm trained as an organist and a harpsichordist.
Oh.
And I still do perform. And I play the piano, but I don't consider myself as much a pianist as I do a performer on those older instruments of the organ and the harpsichord.
Wow. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, we have a group here in Champaign-Urbana that builds organs or repairs organs or...
Oh, the John Buzard Organ Company.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, I just played on one of his magnificent organs up here in the Chicago area a couple weeks ago, and he is a very fine organ builder, and he has instruments all over the United States now.
Yeah. I have to have him back on the show. It's been a couple of years, but I love shining a light on all these wonderful things that are going on right here in Champaign-Urbana, and people don't even realize it. And the symphony is just an incredible treasure that we have right here. And it's kind of like a world-class group, and they're right here in town.
I have to agree with you. In my time in Champaign-Urbana, I've been so impressed at the quality of life and the amount of culture available to people there. Of course, the university is a nexus for that, but it certainly extends beyond the university. And I think Champaign-Urbana enjoys a very high level of access to great art.
Yes, indeed. And what kinds of things are the symphony planning here in this upcoming season?
Well, we have a very sort of all-encompassing season. We have a season basically entitled Our World, Our Music. And we have a lot of epic pieces. We start the season with a really amazing work by Gustav Mahler, his Symphony No. 5, which is one of the biggest, most impressive canvases you can imagine for the symphony orchestra. And we end our season with The Planets by Gustav Holst and Star Wars by John Williams.
So, oh, my
and
goodness.
Between those two, we have, I think, an incredible amount of variety, wonderful soloists, and featuring music that's really cutting edge and of our time. We have been blessed to be one of five orchestras selected from around the country for a major grant from New Music USA. So we are about to have our third and final season to have the composer Stacy Garup in residence with the orchestra. And one of our major concerts, which will be on March 9th, will be the Midwest premiere of Stacy's Oratorio, which is a work for chorus and orchestra and children's chorus called Terra Nostra. And it is about our planet and its past and creation legends and its future, and it's a very exciting opportunity here in Central Illinois for the premiere.
Wow.
The Midwest premiere of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's pretty heady stuff. Now, do they actually, will Stacy actually make compositions or anything, or just be playing the compositions already written?
Well, Stacy will be very much present throughout the season, and she will be present as we rehearse this work. She finished this piece a couple of years ago, but this will be the first time that it's been performed all in one piece. It's an entire concert's worth of music, and
incredible.
It will really involve a lot of the community, because the Central Illinois Children's Chorus will be involved, four excellent professional soloists, and the University of Illinois Oratorio Society. So that's going to be a very special work and event based and focused on planet Earth.
Yeah, I just don't even know how somebody can do that. I mean, the genius behind it. I mean, it just must be some part of their brain that is just glowing with activity, and maybe a lump on the side of their head or something, because their brain is bigger there. I don't know, but how do
I like your image of their brain just glowing, because I think that's more what it is.
Yeah.
Tremendous creativity. And in a work like this, Stacy is very imaginative, and she brings in lots of different images and lots of poetry and literary influences. So she is really a genius. We will also be performing a brand new viola concerto by Stacy in January, and that concerto has its own theme, and it's called Krakatoa. So it's based on the Indonesian volcano.
Wow.
And has a lot of percussion, and that program, I was challenged as a music director, how do I choose a program that relates to this work about a volcano? And I decided to choose a couple pieces from the year 1816, which was known as the Year Without a Summer because of the eruption the previous year of Mount Tambora in Indonesia.
Mm.
And there was so much ash in the environment that they really didn't have a summer. Things stayed so cold around planet Earth that year. So I chose two pieces, one by Rossini, the Overture to the Barber of Seville, and one by Franz Schubert, his Symphony No. 5, and they both came from that year of 1816.
Wow.
And that's sort of one of the fun things about my job, is being challenged creatively to put pieces together in a satisfying but meaningful way. And that concert will finish with music by Stravinsky, his Pulcinella Suite, which is a stage work from the sort of Commedia dell'arte tradition, you know, the Punch and Judy sort of tradition.
Wow.
And so that concert's called All the World's a Stage, and it relates again to our overall theme of our world, our music.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's so wonderful to hear you talk, because it's like an amazing an epiphany for me and maybe our listeners too, as to the depth and the breadth of just everything that goes into the program, and how really well thought through it is, and how it's designed to intrigue and delight and inform and entertain all at the same time. And
oh, I could not have put that better myself. All of the things that you just said, we very much want to entertain, and that's one of the reasons we have Star Wars to finish our season. And, of course, the planets. And you can't listen to Star Wars without hearing a lot of the influence of Gustav Holst's The Planets. It was a very influential piece that Holst wrote back in the beginning of the 20th century. And, that's the goal. We want our audience to thoroughly enjoy what they hear.
Yeah, and I think they will. I mean, it's pretty clear. The interesting thing, I think, about here it is now, I don't know, it's been 35 years, I don't know how, since Williams wrote that Star Wars theme. The decision that Steven Spielberg... You know, if you look at filmmakers back then, I'm thinking about the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger. There was a where he was the cyborg, and
The Terminator.
The Terminator, right? The music in that movie is all synthetic. Okay, and nobody remembers the Terminator theme songs or theme music or anything.
That's right.
And if you listen, it's still a popular movie. You watch it, okay. But the music is just, you listen to the music and you're just like, this music is dated. This music is, so 80s or whatever. And then, 70s or whenever it came out. And then you have this decision by Steven Spielberg saying, no, I'm going to do like a classical orchestral kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to hire, John Williams and we're going to do, I don't know if he was influenced by, I think a 2001, A Space Odyssey, where they used all classical music. And,
that's right.
And it really set the stage for that. I mean, that movie you can watch today and it still seems timeless to me, but people still enjoy the music that was composed for Star Wars, and the decision that he made to go with orchestral music and classical style composition, I think, has met the test of time 10 times over.
That is a great observation. I think when you think about 2001, A Space Odyssey, or Star Wars, they simply seem in a different league than, say, the Terminator. Even though, the other film, The Terminator, was very entertaining and so forth, these approach an entirely different class. And I believe you're exactly right that the use of the symphony orchestra, in the case of Star Wars, it was the London Symphony Orchestra, has a profound effect in all of that. And lots of times you hear conversations today about the relevance of the symphony orchestra. And I think that it remains so relevant because it is continually used in contexts that people enjoy. That would certainly include movies. Just a week before last, I was involved in a concert up here in Chicago with live symphony orchestra and chorus from a video game, the Kingdom Hearts video game. And, packed auditorium theater in Chicago, here, there to hear the live music that they've heard in this video game. And of course Toscanini wasn't involved with something like that, or Bernstein, but it's, you have to stay relevant and you have to recognize how people want to consume music, and the symphony orchestra remains a living organism. That's one of the reasons we're so committed to doing music by living composers of all genders and backgrounds and colors, and in addition to the great masterpieces of the past. So we try to be a springboard for artistic collaboration and experience that spans all sorts of times and cultures, and to remain just as vital as possible. And that includes doing music people love from a film like Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, that's really a neat thing you're doing. And I, just get juiced talking to you and hearing all of the thought you've put into it and love that you've put into it, and also a little whimsy, and make sure people are totally entertained. Now, we just got a minute or so left. How can people learn more about the Symphony Orchestra and your schedule, or get involved or buy tickets or any of those kinds of things?
They simply need to Google the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, and they will see our whole season there. That would include our holiday concert on December 6th, which will be just a super fun event. We have the Chamber Singers of the University of Illinois, the Central Illinois Children's Chorus. It includes Vivaldi's Gloria, but also lots of fun Christmas and holiday pops music. We start our season on October 13th with Mahler Symphony No. 5, and we are featuring an artist from the Metropolitan Opera, soprano Amanda Majeski, and she's going to be singing music by Richard Strauss. You just referenced Richard Strauss with 2001,
yep.
And she will be singing his magnificent four last songs. And we just hope that people will come out to enjoy the orchestra, to support it. It is really an excellent orchestra, and we perform in one of the great concert halls in the United States, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. So that's all there on the Champaign-Urbana Symphony website.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. So they can just go to Google Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, and it'll all be right there for them.
Yes, it's CUSymphony.org.
CUSymphony.org.
See you, Symphony. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Well, we have been talking with Stephen Alltop. He is the music director and conductor of the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Alex, it's a great pleasure. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, and thank you for listening.